Four Past Midnight, The Sun Dog. From the book Four Past Midnight by Stephen King. Read by Tim Sample. September 15th was Kevin's birthday, and he got exactly what he wanted, a son. The Kevin in question was Kevin Delavan. The birthday was his 15th, and the son was a Sun 660, a Polaroid camera, which does everything for the novice photographer except make bologna sandwiches. There were other gifts, of course. His sister Meg gave him a pair of mittens she had knitted herself. There was $10 from his grandmother in Des Moines, and his Aunt Hilda sent, as she always did, a string tie with a horrible clasp. She had sent the first of these when Kevin was 3, which meant he already had 12 unused string ties with horrible clasps in a drawer of his bureau, to which this would be added, lucky 13. He had never worn any of them, but was not allowed to throw them away. Aunt Hilda lived in Portland. She had never come to one of Kevin's or Meg's birthday parties, but she might decide to do just that one of these years. God knew she could. Portland was only 50 miles south of Castle Rock. And suppose she did come, and asked to see Kevin in one of his other ties, or Meg in one of her other scarves, for that matter. With some relatives, an excuse might do. Aunt Hilda, however, was different. Aunt Hilda presented a certain golden possibility at a point where two essential facts about her crossed. She was rich, and she was old. Someday, Kevin's mom was convinced, she might do something for Kevin and Meg. It was understood that the something would probably come after Aunt Hilda finally kicked it, in the form of a clause in her will. In the meantime, it was thought wise to keep the horrible string ties and the equally horrible scarves. So this 13th string tie, on the clasp of which was a bird Kevin thought was a woodpecker, would join the others, and Kevin would write Aunt Hilda a thank you note, not because his mother would insist on it, and not because he thought or even cared that Aunt Hilda might do something for him and his kid sister someday, but because he was a generally thoughtful boy with good habits and no real vices. He thanked his family for all his gifts. His mother and father had, of course, supplied a number of lesser ones, although the Polaroid was clearly the centerpiece, and they were delighted with his delight. Not forgetting to give Meg a kiss, she giggled and pretended to rub it off, but her own delight was equally clear. And to tell her, he was sure the mittens would come in handy on the ski team this winter. But most of his attention was reserved for the Polaroid box and the extra film packs which had come with it. He was a good sport about the birthday cake and the ice cream, although it was clear he was itching to get at the camera and try it out. As soon as he decently could, he did. That was when the trouble started. He read the instruction booklet as thoroughly as his eagerness to begin would allow, then loaded the camera, while the family watched with anticipation and unacknowledged dread. For some reason, the gifts which seem the most wanted are the ones which so often don't work. There was a little collective sigh, more puff than gust, when the camera obediently spat out the cardboard square on top of the film packet, just as the instruction booklet had promised it would. There were two small dots, one red and one green, separated by a zigzag lightning bolt on the housing of the camera. When Kevin loaded the camera, the red light came on. It stayed on for a couple of seconds. The family watched in silent fascination as the Sun 660 sniffed for light. Then the red light went out, and the green light began to blink rapidly. "It's ready," Kevin said in the same straining to be offhand but not quite making it tone with which Neil Armstrong had reported his first step upon the surface of Luna. "Why don't all you guys stand together?" "I hate having my picture taken," Meg cried, covering her face with the theatrical anxiety and pleasure which only sub-teenage girls and really bad actresses can manage. "Come on, Meg," Mr. Delavan said.
"Don't be a goose, Meg," Mrs. Delavan said.
Meg dropped her hands and her objections, and the three of them stood at the end of the table with the diminished birthday cake in the foreground.
Kevin looked through the viewfinder. "Squeeze a little closer to Meg, Mom," he said, motioning with his left hand. "You too, Dad." This time he motioned with his right. "You're squishing me," Meg said to her parents. Kevin put his finger on the button, which would fire the camera, then remembered a briefly glimpsed note in the instructions about how easy it was to cut off your subject's head in a photograph. "Off with their heads," he thought, and it should have been funny, but for some reason he felt a little tingle at the base of his spine, gone and forgotten almost before it was noticed. He raised the camera a little. There, they were all in the frame. Good. "Okay," he sang. "Smile and say intercourse." "Kevin," his mother cried out. His father burst out laughing, and Meg screeched the sort of mad laughter not even bad actresses often essay. Girls between the ages of 10 and 12 own sole title to that particular laugh. Kevin pushed the button. The flashbulb, powered by the battery in the film pack, washed the room in a moment of righteous white light. "It's mine," Kevin thought. And it should have been the surpassing moment of his 15th birthday. Instead, the thought brought back that odd little tingle. It was more noticeable this time. The camera made a noise, something between a squeal and a horror, a sound just a little beyond description, but familiar enough to most people. Just the same, the sound of a Polaroid camera squirting out what may not be art, but what is often serviceable and almost always provides instant gratification.
"Let me see it," Meg cried.
"Hold your horses, Muffin," Mr. Delavan said. "They take a little time to develop." Meg was staring at the stiff gray surface of what was not yet a photograph, with the rapt attention of a woman gazing into a crystal ball. The rest of the family gathered around, and there was that same feeling of anxiety which had attended the ceremony of loading the camera. Still life of the American family waiting to let out its breath. Kevin felt a terrible tenseness stealing into his muscles, and this time there was no question of ignoring it. He could not explain it, but it was there. He could not seem to take his eyes from that solid gray square within the white frame which would form the borders of the photograph.
"I think I see me,"
Meg cried brightly. Then a moment later, "No, I guess I don't. I think I see..." They watched in utter silence as the gray cleared, as the mists are reputed to do in a seer's crystal, when the vibrations or feelings or whatever they are right, and the picture became visible to them. Mr. Delavan was the first to break the silence.
"What is this?" he asked no one in particular. "Some kind of joke?"
Kevin had absently put the camera down rather too close to the edge of the table in order to watch the picture develop. Meg saw what the picture was and took a single step away. The expression on her face was neither fright nor awe, but just ordinary surprise. One of her hands came up as she turned toward her father. The rising hand struck the camera and knocked it off the table and onto the floor. Mrs. Delavan had been looking at the emerging picture in a kind of trance, the expression on her face either that of a woman who is deeply puzzled or who is feeling the onset of a migraine headache. The sound of the camera hitting the floor startled her. She uttered a little scream and recoiled. In doing this, she tripped over Meg's foot and lost her balance. Mr. Delavan reached for her, propelling Meg, who was still between them, forward again, quite forcefully. Mr. Delavan not only caught his wife, but did so with some grace. For a moment, they would have made a pretty picture indeed. Mom and Dad, showing they still know how to cut a rug, caught at the end of a spirited tango, she with one hand thrown up and her back deeply bowed, he bent over her in that ambiguous male posture which may be seen when divorced from circumstance as either solicitude or lust. Meg was 11 and less graceful. She went flying back toward the table and smacked into it with her stomach. The hit was hard enough to have injured her, but for the last year and a half she had been taking ballet lessons at the YWCA 3 afternoons a week. She did not dance with much grace, but she enjoyed ballet, and the dancing had fortunately toughened the muscles of her stomach, enough for them to absorb the blow as efficiently as good shock absorbers absorb the pounding a road full of potholes can administer to a car. Still, there was a band of black and blue just above her hips the next day. These bruises took almost 2 weeks to first purple, then yellow, then fade,
like a Polaroid picture in reverse. At the moment this Rube Goldberg accident happened, she didn't even feel it. She simply banged into the table and cried out. The table tipped. The birthday cake, which should have been in the foreground of Kevin's first picture with his new camera, slid off the table. Mrs. Delavan didn't even have time to start her, "Meg, are you all right?" before the remaining half of the cake fell on top of the Sun 660 with a juicy splat that sent frosting all over their shoes and the baseboard of the wall. The viewfinder, heavily smeared with Dutch chocolate, peered out like a periscope. That was all. Happy birthday, Kevin. Kevin and Mr. Delavan were sitting on the couch in the living room that evening when Mrs. Delavan came in, waving two dog-eared sheets of paper which had been stapled together. Kevin and Mr. Delavan both had open books in their laps, The Best and the Brightest for the father, Shootout at Laredo for the son. But what they were mostly doing was staring at the Sun camera, which sat in disgrace on the coffee table amid a litter of Polaroid pictures. All the pictures appeared to show exactly the same thing. Meg was sitting on the floor in front of them, using the VCR to watch a rented movie. Kevin wasn't sure which one it was, but there were a lot of people running around and screaming, so he guessed it was a horror picture. Megan had a passion for them. Both parents considered this a low taste. Mr. Delavan, in particular, was often outraged by what he called that useless junk. But tonight, neither of them had said a word. Kevin guessed that they were just grateful she had quit complaining about her bruised stomach and wondering aloud what the exact symptoms of a ruptured spleen might be. "Here they are," Mrs. Delavan said. "I found them at the bottom of my purse the second time through." She handed the papers, a sales slip from J.C. Penney's and a MasterCard receipt, to her husband. "I can never find anything like this the first time. I don't think anyone can. It's like a law of nature." She surveyed her husband and son, hands on her hips. "You two look like someone just killed the family cat." "We don't have a cat," Kevin said. "Well, you know what I mean. It's a shame, of course, but we'll get it sorted out in no time. Penny's will be happy to exchange it."
"I'm not so sure of that," John Delavan said. He picked up the camera, looked at it with distaste, almost sneered at it, in fact, then set it down again. "It got chipped when it hit the floor, see?" Mrs. Delavan took only a cursory glance.
"Well, if Penny's won't, I'm positive that the Polaroid company will. I mean, the fall obviously didn't cause whatever is wrong with it. The first picture looked just like all these, and Kevin took that one before Meg knocked it off the table."
"I didn't mean to,"
Meg said without turning around. On the screen, a pint-sized figure, a malevolent doll named Chucky, if Kevin had it right, was chasing a small boy. Chucky was dressed in blue overalls and waving a knife.
"I know, dear. How's your stomach?"
"Hurts," Meg said. "A little ice cream might help. Is there any left over?"
"Yes, I think so." Meg gifted her mother with her most winning smile.
"Would you get some for me?"
"Not at all," Mrs. Delavan said pleasantly. "Get it yourself.
And what's that horrible thing you're watching?"
"Child's play," Megan said. "There's this doll named Chucky that comes to life. It's neat."
Mrs. Delavan wrinkled her nose.
"Dolls don't come to life, Meg," her father said.
He spoke heavily, as if knowing this was a lost cause.
"Chucky did," Meg said. "In movies, anything can happen."
She used the remote control to freeze the movie and went to get her ice cream.
"Why does she want to watch that crap?" Mr. Delavan asked his wife, almost plaintively.
"I don't know, dear."
Kevin had picked up the camera in one hand and several of the exposed Polaroids in the other. They had taken almost a dozen in all.
"I'm not so sure I want a refund," he said.
His father stared at him.
"What?"
Jesus wept.
"Well," Kevin said a little defensively, "I'm just saying that maybe we ought to think about it. I mean, it's not exactly an ordinary defect, is it? I mean, if the pictures came out overexposed or underexposed or just plain blank, that would be one thing. But how do you get a thing like this? The same picture over and over. I mean, look. And they're outdoors, even though we took every one of these pictures inside."
"It's a practical joke," his father said.
"It must be. The thing to do is just exchange the damn thing and forget about it."
"I don't think it's a practical joke," Kevin said. First, it's too complicated to be a practical joke. How do you rig a camera to take the same picture over and over? Plus, the psychology is all wrong.
Psychology yet, Mr. Delavan said, rolling his eyes at his wife.
Yes, psychology, Kevin replied firmly. When a guy loads your cigarette or hands you a stick of pepper gum, he hangs around to watch the fun, doesn't he? But unless you or Mom have been pulling my leg...
Your father isn't much of a leg puller, dear, Mrs. Delavan said, stating the obvious gently. Mr. Delavan was looking at Kevin with his lips pressed together. It was the look he always got when he perceived his son drifting toward that area of the ballpark where Kevin seemed most at home, left field, far left field. There was a hunchy, intuitive streak in Kevin that had always puzzled and confounded him. He didn't know where it had come from, but he was sure it hadn't been his side of the family. He sighed and looked at the camera again. A piece of black plastic had been chipped from the left side of the housing, and there was a crack, surely no thicker than a human hair, down the center of the viewfinder lens. The crack was so thin it disappeared completely when you raised the camera to get your eye to set the shot you would not get. What you would get was on the coffee table, and there were nearly a dozen other examples in the dining room. What you got was something that looked like a refugee from the local animal shelter.
All right, what in the devil are you going to do with it, he asked. I mean, let's think this over reasonably, Kevin. What practical good is a camera that takes the same picture over and over?
But it was not practical good Kevin was thinking about. In fact, he was not thinking at all. He was feeling and remembering. In the instant when he had pushed the shutter release, one clear idea, it's mine, had filled his mind as completely as the momentary white flash had filled his eyes. That idea, complete, yet somehow inexplicable, had been accompanied by a powerful mixture of emotions which he could still not identify completely, but he thought fear and excitement had predominated. And besides, his father always wanted to look at things reasonably. He would never be able to understand Kevin's intuitions or Meg's interest in killer dolls named Chucky. Meg came back in with a huge dish of ice cream and started the movie again. Someone was now attempting to toast Chucky with a blowtorch, but he went right on, waving his knife.
Are you two still arguing?
We're having a discussion, Mr. Delavan said. His lips were pressed more tightly together than ever.
Yeah, right, Meg said, sitting down on the floor again and crossing her legs. You always say that.
Meg, Kevin said kindly.
What? If you dump that much ice cream on top of a ruptured spleen, you'll die horribly in the night. Of course, your spleen might not actually be ruptured, but...
Meg stuck her tongue out and turned back to the movie. Mr. Delavan was looking at his son with an expression of mingled affection and exasperation.
Look, Kev, it's your camera. No argument about that. You can do whatever you want with it, but...
Dad, aren't you even the least bit interested in why it's doing what it's doing?
Nope, John Delavan said.
It was Kevin's turn to roll his eyes. Meanwhile, Mrs. Delavan was looking from one to the other like someone who's enjoying a pretty good tennis match. Nor was this far from the truth. She had spent years watching her son and her husband sharpen themselves on each other, and she was not bored with it yet. She sometimes wondered if they would ever discover how much alike they really were.
Well, I want to think it over.
Fine. I just want you to know that I can swing by Penny's tomorrow and exchange the thing, if you want me to, and they agree to swap a piece of chip merchandise, that is. If you want to keep it, that's fine, too. I wash my hands of it.
He dusted his palms briskly together to illustrate. I suppose you don't want my opinion, Meg said.
Right, Kevin said.
Of course we do, Meg, Mrs. Delavan said. I think it's a supernatural camera, Meg said. She licked ice cream from her spoon. I think it's a manifestation.
That's utterly ridiculous, Mr. Delavan said at once.
No, it's not, Meg said. It happens to be the only explanation that fits. You just don't think so because you don't believe in stuff like that. If a ghost ever floated up to you, Dad, you wouldn't even see it. What do you think, Kev?
For a moment, Kevin couldn't answer. He felt as if another flashbulb had gone off, this one behind his eyes instead of in front of them.
Kev! Earth to Kevin!
I think you might just have something there, Squirt, he said slowly.
Oh, my dear God, John Delavan said, getting up. It's the revenge of Freddy and Jason. My kid thinks his birthday camera's haunted. I'm going to bed. But before I do, I want to say just one more thing. A camera that takes photographs of the same thing over and over again, especially something as ordinary as what's in these pictures, is a boring manifestation of the supernatural.
Still, Kevin said. He held up the photos like a dubious poker hand.
I think it's time we all went to bed, Mrs. Delavan said briskly. Meg, if you absolutely need to finish that cinematic masterpiece, you can do it in the morning.
But it's almost over, Meg cried.
I'll come up with her, Mom, Kevin said. And 15 minutes later, with the malevolent Chucky disposed of, at least until the sequel, he did. But sleep did not come easily for Kevin that night. He lay long awake in his bedroom, listening to a strong late summer wind rustle the leaves outside into whispery conversation, thinking about what might make a camera take the same picture over and over and over again, and what such a thing might mean. He only began to slip towards sleep when he realized his decision had been made. He would keep the Polaroid sun at least a little while longer. It's mine, he thought again. He rolled over on his side, closed his eyes, and was sleeping deeply 40 seconds later. Amid the tickings and talkings of what sounded like at least 50,000 clocks, and totally undisturbed by them, Reginald Pop Merrill shone a pencil beam of light from a gadget even more slender than a doctor's ophthalmoscope into Kevin's Polaroid 660, while Kevin stood by. Pop's eyeglasses, which he didn't need for close work, were propped on the bald dome of his head.
Uh-huh,
he said, and clicked the light off.
Does that mean you know what's wrong with it? Kevin asked.
Nope, Pop Merrill said, and snapped the sun's film compartment, now empty, closed.
Don't have a clue.
And before Kevin could say anything else, the clocks began to strike 4 o'clock. And for a few moments, conversation, although possible, seemed absurd.
I want to think it over, he had told his father on the evening he had turned 15, 3 days ago now. And it was a statement which had surprised both of them.
As a child, he had made a career of not thinking about things, and Mr. Delavan had in his heart of hearts come to believe Kevin never would think about things, whether he ought to or not. They had been seduced, as fathers and sons often are, by the idea that their behavior and very different modes of thinking would never change, thus fixing their relationship eternally, and childhood would thus go on forever. I want to think it over. There was a world of potential change implicit in that statement. Further, as a human being who had gone through his life to that point making most decisions on instinct rather than reason, and he was one of those lucky ones whose instincts were almost always good, the sort of person, in other words, who drives reasonable people mad, Kevin was surprised and intrigued to find that he was actually on the horns of a dilemma. Horn number one. He had wanted a Polaroid camera, and he had gotten one for his birthday. But, damn it, he had wanted a Polaroid camera that worked. Horn number two. He was deeply intrigued by Meg's use of the word supernatural. His younger sister had a daffy streak a mile wide, but she wasn't stupid, and Kevin didn't think she had used the word lightly or thoughtlessly. His father, who was of the reasonable rather than instinctive tribe, had scoffed, but Kevin found he wasn't ready to go and do likewise, at least not yet. That word, that fascinating, exotic word, it became a plinth which his mind couldn't help circling. I think it's a manifestation. Kevin was amused and a little chagrined that only Meg had been smart enough or brave enough to actually say what should have occurred to all of them, given the oddity of the pictures the sun produced. But in truth, it wasn't really that amazing. They were not a religious family. They went to church on the Christmas day every third year when Aunt Hilda came to spend the holiday with them instead of her other remaining relatives. But except for the occasional wedding or funeral,
That was about all. If any of them truly believed in the invisible world, it was Megan, who couldn't get enough of walking corpses, living dolls, and cars that came to life and ran down people they didn't like. Neither of Kevin's parents had much taste for the bizarre. They didn't read their horoscopes in the daily paper. They would never mistake comets or falling stars for signs from the Almighty. Where one couple might see the face of Jesus on the bottom of an enchilada, John and Mary Delavan would see only an overcooked enchilada. It was not surprising that Kevin, who had never seen the man in the moon because neither mother nor father had bothered to point it out to him, had been likewise unable to see the possibility of a supernatural manifestation in a camera, which took the same picture over and over again, inside or outside, even in the dark of his bedroom closet, until it was suggested to him by his sister, who had once written a fan letter to Jason and gotten an autographed glossy photo of a guy in a blood-stained hockey mask by return mail. Once the possibility had been pointed out, it became difficult to unthink. As Dostoevsky, that smart old Russian, once said to his little brother when the two of them were both smart young Russians, try to spend the next 30 seconds not thinking of a blue-eyed polar bear. It was hard to do. So he had spent 2 days circling that plinth in his mind, trying to read hieroglyphics that weren't even there for pity's sake, and trying to decide which he wanted more, the camera or the possibility of a manifestation. Or, put another way, whether he wanted the sun or the man in the moon. By the end of the second day, even in 15-year-olds who are clearly destined for the reasonable tribe, dilemmas rarely last longer than a week, he had decided to take the man in the moon, on a trial basis at least. He came to this decision in study hall period 7, and when the bell rang, signaling the end of both the study hall and the school day, he had gone to the teacher he respected most, Mr. Baker, and had asked him if he knew of anyone who repaired cameras. Not like a regular camera shop guy, he explained. More like a, you know, a thoughtful guy. An F-stop philosopher? Mr. Baker asked. His saying things like that was one of the reasons why Kevin respected him. It was just a cool thing to say. A sage of the shutter. An alchemist of the aperture. A guy who's seen a lot, Kevin said cagily. Pop Merrill, Mr. Baker said. Who? He runs the Emporium Galorium. Oh, that place. Yeah, Mr. Baker said, grinning. That place. If that is what you're looking for is a sort of homespun Mr. Fix-It. I guess that's what I'm looking for. He's got damn near everything in there, Mr. Baker said, and Kevin could agree with that. Even though he had never actually been inside, he passed the Emporium Galorium 5, 10, maybe 15 times a week. In a town the size of Castle Rock, you had to pass everything a lot, and it got amazingly boring, in Kevin Delavan's humble opinion. And he had looked in the windows. It seemed crammed literally to the rafters with objects, most of them mechanical. But his mother called it a junk store, in a sniffing voice, and his father said Mr. Merrill made his money rooking the summer people. And so Kevin had never gone in. If it had only been a junk store, he might have, almost certainly would have, in fact. But doing what the summer people did, or buying something where summer people got rooked, was unthinkable. He would be as apt to wear a blouse and skirt to high school. Summer people could do what they wanted, and did. They were all mad, and conducted their affairs in a mad fashion. Exist with them? Fine. But be confused with them? No, no, and no, sir. Damn near everything, Mr. Baker repeated. And most of what he's got, he fixed himself. He thinks that Cracker Barrel philosopher act he does, glasses up on top of the head, wise pronouncements, all of that, fools people. No one who knows him disabuses him. I'm not sure anyone would dare disabuse him. Why? What do you mean? Mr. Baker shrugged. An odd, tight little smile touched his mouth. Pop, Mr. Merrill, I mean,
He's got his fingers in a lot of pies around here. You'd be surprised, Kevin. Kevin didn't care about how many pies Pop Merrill was currently fingering or what their fillings might be. He was left with only one more important question. Since the summer people were gone, he could probably slink into the Emporium Galorium unseen tomorrow afternoon if he took advantage of the rule which allowed all students but freshmen to cut their last period study hall twice a month.
"Do I call him Pop or Mr. Merrill?"
Solemnly, Mr. Baker replied, "I think the man kills anyone under the age of 60 who calls him Pop." And the thing was, Kevin had an idea Mr. Baker wasn't exactly joking.
"You really don't know, huh?"
Kevin said when the clocks began to wind down. It had not been like in a movie, where they all start and finish striking at once. These were real clocks, and he guessed that most of them, along with the rest of the appliances in the Emporium Galorium, were not really running at all, but sort of lurching along. They had begun at what his own Seiko quartz watch said was 3:58. They began to pick up speed and volume gradually, like an old truck fetching second gear with a tired groan and jerk. There were maybe 4 seconds when all of them really did seem to be striking, bonging, chiming, clanging, and cuckooing at the same time. But 4 seconds was all the synchronicity they could manage. And winding down was not exactly what they did. What they did was sort of give up, like water finally consenting to gurgle its way down a drain, which is almost but not quite completely plugged. He didn't have any idea why he was so disappointed. Had he really expected anything else? For Pop Merrill, whom Mr. Baker had described as a Cracker Barrel philosopher and homespun Mr. Fix-It, to pull out a spring and say,
"Here it is. This is the bastard causing that dog to show up every time you push the shutter release. It's a dog spring. Belongs in one of those toy dogs. A kid winds up so it'll walk in back a little. Some joker on the Polaroid Sun 660 assembly line's always putting them in the damn cameras."
Had he expected that? No. But he had expected something.
"Don't have a friggin' clue,"
Pop repeated cheerfully. He reached behind him and took a Douglas MacArthur corncob pipe from a holder shaped like a bucket seat. He began to tamp tobacco into it from an imitation leather pouch with the words, "Evil weed," stamped into it.
"Can't even take these babies apart, you know."
"You can't?"
"Nope,"
Pop said. He was just as chipper as a bird. He paused long enough to hook a thumb over the wire ridge between the lenses of his rimless specs and give them a yank. They dropped off his bald dome and fell neatly into place, hiding the red spots on the side of his nose with a fleshy little thump.
"You could take apart the old ones,"
he went on, now producing a diamond blue-tip match from a pocket of his vest. Of course he was wearing a vest, and pressing the thick yellow thumbnail of his right hand on its head. Yes, this was a man who could rook the summer people with one hand tied behind his back, always assuming it wasn't the one he used to first fish out his matches and then light them. Even at 15 years of age, Kevin could see that. Pop Merrill had style.
"The Polaroid land cameras, I mean. Ever see one of those beauties?"
"No," Kevin said. Pop snapped the match alight on the first try, which, of course, he would always do, and applied it to the corncob, his words sending out little smoke signals, which looked pretty and smelled absolutely foul.
"Oh, yeah," he said. "They look like those old-time cameras people like Matthew Brady used before the turn of the century, or before the Kodak people introduced the Brownie box camera, anyway. What I mean to say is..."
Kevin was rapidly learning that this was Pop Merrill's favorite phrase. He used it the way some of the kids in school used, you know, as intensifier, modifier, qualifier, and most of all as a convenient thought-gathering pause.
"They tricked it up some. Put on chrome and real leather side panels, but it still looked old-fashioned, like the sort of camera folks used to make daguerreotypes with. When you opened up one of those old Polaroid land cameras, it snapped out an accordion neck because the lens needed half a foot, maybe even 9 inches, to focus the image. It looked old-fashioned as hell when you put it next to one of the Kodaks in the late 40s and early 50s, and it was like those old daguerreotype cameras in another way. It only took black-and-white photos.
Is that so? Kevin asked, interested in spite of himself.
Oh, yeah,
Pop said, chipper as a chickadee, blue eyes twinkling at Kevin through the smoke from his fuming stew pot of a pipe and from behind his round, rimless glasses. It was the sort of twinkle which may indicate either good humor or avarice.
What I mean to say is that people laughed at those cameras the way they laughed at the Volkswagen Beetles when they first come out. But they bought the Polaroids just like they bought the VWs, because the Beetles got good gas mileage and didn't go bust so often as American cars. And the Polaroids did one thing the Kodaks and even the Nikons and Minoltas and Leicas didn't.
Took instant pictures? Pop smiled.
Well, not exactly. What I mean to say is, you took your picture, then you yanked on this flap to pull it out. It didn't have no motor, didn't make that squidgy little whining noise like modern Polaroids.
So there was a perfect way to describe that sound after all. It was just that you had to find a Pop Merrill to tell it to you. The sound that Polaroid cameras made when they spat out their product was a squidgy little whine.
Then you had to time her,
Pop said. Time?
Oh, yeah,
Pop said with great relish, bright as the early bird who has found that fabled worm.
What I mean to say is, they didn't have none of this happy automatic crappy back in those days. You yanked, and out come this long strip, which you put on the table or whatever, and timed off 60 seconds on your watch. Had to be 60, or right around there anyway. Less, and you'd have an underexposed picture. More, and it'd be overexposed.
Wow, Kevin said respectfully. And this was not bogus respect, jollying the old man along in hopes he would get back to the point, which was not a bunch of long-dead cameras that had been wonders in their day, but his own camera, the damned balky Sun 660, sitting on Pop's work table, with the guts of an old seven-day clock on its right and something which looked suspiciously like a dildo on its left. It wasn't bogus respect, and Pop knew it, and it occurred to Pop, it wouldn't have to Kevin, how fleeting that great white god, state-of-the-art, really was. 10 years, he thought, and the phrase itself would be gone. From the boy's fascinated expression, you would have thought he was hearing about something as antique as George Washington's wooden dentures instead of a camera everyone had thought was the ultimate only 35 years ago. But, of course, this boy had still been circling around in the unhatched void 35 years ago, part of a female who hadn't yet even met the male who would provide his other half.
What I mean to say is, it was a regular little back room going on in there between the picture and the backing.
Pop resumed, slow at first, but speeding up as his own mostly genuine interest in the subject resurfaced. But the thoughts of who this kid's father was, and what the kid might be worth to him, and the strange thing the kid's camera was up to never completely left his mind.
And at the end of the minute, you peeled the picture off the back. Had to be careful when you did it, too, because there was all this goo-like jelly on the back. And if your skin was in the least bit sensitive, you could get a pretty good burn.
Awesome, Kevin said. His eyes were wide, and now he looked like a kid hearing about the old two-holer outhouses, which Pop and all his childhood colleagues, they were almost all colleagues, he had had few childhood friends in Castle Rock, perhaps preparing even then for his life's work of rooking the summer people, and the other children somehow sensing it, like a faint smell of skunk, had taken for granted, doing your business as fast as you could in high summer, because one of the wasps, always circling around down there between the manna and the two holes which were the heaven from which the manna fell, might at any time take a notion to plant its stinger in one of your tender little boy cheeks, and also doing it as fast as you could in deep winter, because your tender little boy cheeks were apt to freeze solid if you didn't.
Well, Pop thought, so much for the camera of the future. 35 years, and to this kid it's interesting in the same way a backyard shithouse is interesting. The negative was on the back,
Pop said.
And your positive, well, it was black and white, but it was fine black and white. It was just as crisp and clear as you'd ever want, even today. And you had this little pink thing, about as long as a school eraser, as I remember. It squeegeed out some kind of chemical, smelled like ether, and you had to rub it over the pitcher as fast as you could, or that pitcher would roll right up, like the tube in the middle of a roll of bung fodder.
Kevin burst out laughing, tickled by these pleasant antiquities. Pop quit long enough to get his pipe going again. When he had, he resumed.
A camera like that, nobody but the Polaroid people really knew what it was doing. I mean to say, those people were close, but it was mechanical. You could take it apart.
He looked at Kevin's son with some distaste.
And lots of times, when one went bust, that was as much as you needed. Fella'd come in with one of those and say it wouldn't work, moaning about how he'd have to send it back to the Polaroid people to get it fixed, and that'd probably take months, and would I take a look? Well, I'd say, probably nothing I can do. What I mean to say is nobody really knows about these cameras but the Polaroid people and the goddamn close. But I'll take a look. All the time knowing it was probably just a loose screw inside that shutter housing, or maybe a fouled spring, or hell, maybe Junior slathered some peanut butter in the film compartment.
One of his bright bird eyes dropped in a wink so quick and so marvelously sly that Kevin thought, if you hadn't known he was talking about summer people, you would have thought it was your paranoid imagination, or, more likely, missed it entirely.
What I mean to say is you had your perfect situation,
Pop said.
If you could fix it, you were a goddamn wonder worker. Why, I've put $8.50 in my pocket for taking a couple of little pieces of potato chip out from between the trigger and the shutter spring, my son, and the woman who brought that camera in kissed me on the lips, right on the lips.
Kevin observed Pop's eye drop momentarily closed again behind the semi-transparent mat of blue smoke.
And of course, if it was something you couldn't fix, they didn't hold it against you because, what I mean to say, they never really expected you to be able to do nothing in the first place. It was only a last resort before they put her in the box and stuffed newspaper around her to keep her from being broke even worse in the mail and shipped her off to Schenectady. But this camera...
He spoke in the ritualistic tone of distaste all philosophers of the Cracker Barrel, whether in Athens of the Golden Age or in a small-town junk shop during this current one of brass, adopt to express their view of entropy without having to come right out and state it.
Wasn't put together, son. What I mean to say is it was poured. I could maybe pop the lens and will if you want me to, and I did look in the film compartment. Although I knew I wouldn't see a goddamn thing wrong, that I recognized at least, and I didn't. But beyond that, I can't go. I could take a hammer and wind it right to her, could break it, what I mean to say, but fix it?
He spread his hands in pipe smoke.
No, sir.
Then I guess I'll just have to return it after all, he meant to finish, but Pop broke in.
Anyway, son, I think you knew that. What I mean to say is you're a bright boy. You can see when a thing's all of a piece. I don't think you brought that camera in to be fixed. I think you know that even if it wasn't all of a piece, a man couldn't fix what that thing's doing, at least not with a screwdriver. I think you brought it in to ask me if I knew what it's up to.
Do you? Kevin asked. He was suddenly tense all over.
I might,
Pop Merrill said calmly. He bent over the pile of photographs. 28 of them now, counting the one Kevin had snapped to demonstrate and the one Pop had snapped to demonstrate to himself.
These in order?
Not really. Pretty close, though. Does it matter?
I think so,
Pop said.
They're a little bit different, ain't they? Not much, but a little.
Yeah, Kevin said. I can see the difference in some of them, but...
Do you know which one is the first? I could probably figure it out for myself, but time is money, son.
That's easy, Kevin said, and picked one out of the untidy little pile. See the frosting? He pointed at a small brown spot on the picture's white edging.
Yep.
Pop didn't spare the dab of frosting more than a glance. He looked closely at the photograph, and after a moment, he opened the drawer of his work table. Tools were littered untidily about inside. To one side, in its own space, was an object wrapped in jeweler's velvet. Pop took this out, folded the cloth back, and removed a large magnifying glass with a switch in its base. He bent over the Polaroid and pushed the switch. A bright circle of light fell on the picture's surface.
That's neat, Kevin said.
Hey,
Pop said again. Kevin could tell that for Pop he was no longer there. Pop was studying the picture closely. If one had not known the odd circumstances of its taking, the picture would hardly have seemed to warrant such close scrutiny. Like most photographs which are taken with a decent camera, good film, and by a photographer at least intelligent enough to keep his finger from blocking the lens, it was clear, understandable, and like so many Polaroids, oddly undramatic. It was a picture in which you could identify and name each object, but its content was as flat as its surface. It was not well composed, but composition wasn't what was wrong with it. That undramatic flatness could hardly be called wrong at all, any more than a real day in a real life could be called wrong because nothing worthy of even a made-for-television movie happened during its course. As in so many Polaroids, the things in the picture were only there, like an empty chair on a porch, or an unoccupied child's swing in a backyard, or a passengerless car sitting at an unremarkable curb without even a flat tire to make it interesting or unique. What was wrong with the picture was the feeling that it was wrong. Kevin had remembered the sense of unease he had felt while composing his subjects for the picture he meant to take, and the ripple of goose flesh up his back when, with the glare of the flashbulb still lighting the room, he had thought, "It's mine."